Hi, I'm Stan Brackage, and I'm thinking of Debussy again today. It was considered so extraordinary in the late 19th century and early 20th that a man should conceive to try to engender a sense of image through music. And I guess people have somewhat grown used to that idea, at least in the early forms of it. Just to give a semblance, here is the end of Debussy's, a section near the end of Debussy's La Mer, or The Sea. And so why does that give us a sense of the sea? I mean, the sea sounds totally different than that. You could, any child could and often does with the mouth make sea sounds that are more easily recognizable. For example, so forth. I mean, the voice can imitate that sound. And yet, there is a quality to that piece that hauntingly is like the sea. I don't know. Sometimes I think if it had been called High Winds Over Bermuda, it might also give us some of that sense. But as I've listened to it over and over again, I think not so perfectly. So as I struggled with it and struggled to understand it, I came to realize it was rhythm and texture that were the two things that were engendering picture. That's the rhythm. Debussy's listening to the rhythm of the sea, not just the rhythm, but the varieties of rhythms, and using different kinds of instruments, different kinds of textures, that is, to give that sense of ocean. Actually, that's all that is really useful in music accompanying any film. You can take any melody in the world, and by just shifting its rhythm and tempo, you can use it to accompany appropriately any kind of film scene. It's the changing of the rhythm, and then, much less important, but still very useful, the texture, which makes a piece of music appropriate to a particular scene. You can try that yourself. Just take some familiar piece of music, and by slowing it down and changing its rhythm or speeding it up or making it martial, you can make it fit a love scene or a war scene. Just rhythm and tempo. Well, that's one of the oldest tricks in the world. Here's a kind of magic that comes from the Elizabethan era. It's Elizabethan folk song, and a very bawdy one, too. I mean, you know, when in the springtime a young man's fancy lightly turns to love. And the song is sort of a kind of cockcrow, Elizabethan cockcrow, sung, by the way, by Ed McCurdy with Eric Darling on the banjo, a record long, long since out of print. give you an example, because it's the rhythm and the texture of not only approximating the sexual act, but just horseback riding to get to it, for example, which gives this piece its power and pictorial evocation.
Oh boy, hey boy, come away boy, and bring me my longing desire. A lass that is neat and can well do the feat when lusty young blood is on fire. Let her body be tall, let her waist be small, and her age not above 18. Let her care for no bed, but here let her spread her mantle upon the green. Let her have cherry lips where I nectar may sip. Let her eyes be as black as a sloe. Dangling locks I do love, so that those hang above are the same with what grows below. Let her face be fair, her breasts be bare, and a voice let her have that can warble. Let her belly be soft, but to mount me aloft, let her bounding buttocks be marble.
I just have to take a little time to tell you a story. That record is so important to me because it is a result of hearing that somewhere between Christmas and New Year's Eve. Oh my goodness, it'd be 26 years ago now. Drunk I was at a party of some friends who just had received this record and were delightedly playing it. And it was hearing that piece of music that sent me spinning immediately out of the party and back to where I knew Jane was, and proposing to her after my fashion, which was yelling at her for 2 hours that if she was just having an affair with an artist, then she should get out of my life, but otherwise she should stay with me. And then I collapsed onto the bed, my head spinning, and the next thing I knew, I heard her on the phone to her parents saying that she was eloping with Brackage. So I puzzled over that piece of music, in fact, that whole record in the intervening years. I was too drunk to really listen to the words, and in a way, they kind of offend me, as I'm sure they would a lot of women these days. They'd say, oh yeah, in the spring, a young man's fancy lightly turns to rape, or some such. Be that as it may, it was along a line of rhythms and a kind of a itchy texture of banjo-ness that I realized that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with Jane. Within a year, we had a baby, and we were moved from Denver and back in New York City. And I had been to the Brussels World's Fair and returned and was having an interview with one of the most extraordinary aestheticians. I don't want to call him a critic, though that's what he's usually called, because I don't like the term. He was greater than that. He was one of the greatest aestheticians of our time. And Parker Tyler, I'll just read you what Jane has written about Parker Tyler for her book that she's writing about those days. She's writing it in the style of the Mabinogion. Anyway, here's what she says about Parker Tyler. Quote, Parker Tyler, why, had in his youth worn a flowing cape and sandals to show his golden toenails as he sang in bars for his supper and a bed. But now Parker Tyler was more sedate and was very brilliant and a critic and could cut anyone into stew beef with his tongue in 3 seconds flat if he decided to. End quote. Well, that's Jane's impression from the time. She was sitting in the background trying to keep the baby quiet, that baby Marina, who's now 25 years old. Why I want to play this tape for you is not just the aesthetic talk or to bring alive something of Parker Tyler to you, but if you'll have the patience to listen, instead of trying to screen out the sound of the baby, as Parker and I were in our annoyance and Jane in her embarrassment, But listen to how the sound of this crying baby affects this conversation.
Eisenstein's theory of an artist like Eisenstein, a vertical montage, that is of exactly correlating sound, such as music or any kind of background sound, speech, and the visual image, to correlate them exactly. Do you feel that that's an idea, that's something that you might work towards, or do you discard it, really?
Well, I don't discard it. Actually, I look on it as the last authentic aesthetic advance in the use of sound in relation to the moving picture image. Are those notes and fragments and semi-experiments in Eisenstein's work? I don't feel anyone has progressed beyond that point. Many experimental, so-called, quote, experimental filmmakers, unquote, which I more like to refer to as individual filmmakers now, have attempted to use, the only advance they have made is to try to make use of music concrete or some form thereof. And that is to use actual live sounds as music. And this somehow does make an interesting new direction for film, because these live sounds are in some relationship to the actual real images, the sense of the real that we get from photography, therefore the, quote, real images which they are photographing and cutting and using and creating some kind of a work in motion with rhythm out of. So the relationship between the source of material for their visual statement and the source of material for their sound statement, if they're using music concrete, is close. But otherwise, there has been no advance. That is, for instance, the combination of the music concrete idea with film has produced no musical advance, nor no real visual advance in aesthetically.
To apply this to some of your own films. In Reflections on Black, for example, you use a soundtrack made up of boys playing in the street, don't you?
Yes.
Well, I think that that as a musical, musical corollary, augmentation of your visual idea is very successful, because in a way the things, the extraordinary things that are happening and the sort of way in which you've externalized an internal, like psychological action in the story you tell visually, could have as a physical background such sounds happening out in the street while these things are taking place inside. I think it's successful there, but do you think that music concrete can be used abstractly too? That is, the sounds having no relation, or having no relation in life to the things that are going on the screen.
Well, I think most usually, and I'm drawing again from my experience at Brussels in seeing so many, again, quote, experimental films, unquote, that this is that most of the musique concrète is used as if it were music, period. That is, to create very much the same kind of mood as the Hollywood musical orchestra does, only you're using sounds instead of instruments. They haven't, and very few filmmakers have begun to explore the possibilities of using sound in a more literary relationship to the visual image. That is, they have not just taken a musical score made out of sounds and used it to accompany or create an overall mood for a scene, but have broken down the source of those sounds, like siren and so on, or siren, riveting machine. And rather than combine those with an actual pictured riveting machine on the screen or an ambulance rushing somewhere, have used them with an extra sense of dimension by putting them over, for instance, a tense, dramatical, psychological scene. But they have used them with the sense of what the riveting machine is as a source of sound and what the siren is, only not used them to accompany those visual images.
Well, that's just pure. That's the way of using words abstractly, and you make all right in a concert hall. Just think of the human voice and various accidental sounds in the street as making a kind of music. But you think it, such things could be used in film successfully, provided they're used with a certain taste and instinct for dramatic contrast.
The ideology of musique, the idea of musique concrète, that is, as I read it, music composed out of sounds rather than musical instruments, recorded sounds, offers tremendous possibilities to the filmmaker to extend his dramatical statements rather than simply the way they have been used to extend, to create a new and unusual type of music to accompany the mood of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Music is most generally used in a in Hollywood film, let's say, you know, not only Hollywood, but foreign commercial films. Even the best, music is always used essentially to create a mood. And all in once breaking this down, I discovered that that the only variants in music out of which this mood is created are really rhythm and tempo. For instance, I can take any piece of classical music, and merely if I'm allowed to vary its mood and its rhythm and its tempo, I can make it fit a love scene, a cowboy scene, a sad scene.
And so the old filmmaker meets himself coming around again in his youth, and you can see some of my ideas have not changed much. They are solid ideas. It doesn't mean they haven't been questioned over the years. It's a wonderful scene, in a way. Here are two men trying not to notice the baby, and the baby is not only a wonderful, appropriate background to the whole conversation, but is affecting the very choice of words and the very rhythms they're using. Charles Ives is the master of this kind of thing, and I always think it has a lot to do with his father, George Ives, who was the bandmaster in Danbury, Connecticut, as little Charlie was growing up. He must have been an amazing man. He loved to send bands all over the town in different directions, each playing different tunes. And a lot of the people in Danbury thought he was crazy, but liked him all the same. His son always said he was a great man. His father encouraged the townspeople to sing out each in his own way and not to worry about being in tune or anything like that. And once someone came and complained, one of the people in the choir of his father complained because he'd been to the Boston Conservatory and he was disturbed at the voice of the best stonemason in town. And he said he sings off key, the wrong notes and everything, and that horrible, raucous voice, he said. And Charles Ives' father, George, said, "Watch him closely and reverently. Don't pay too much attention to the sounds, for if you do, you may miss the music. You won't get a wild, heroic ride to heaven on pretty little sounds." Well, all this rubbed off very beautifully on Charles Ives, and what I want to play for you next is Gunther Schuller conducting a piece called From the Steeples and Mountains, in which Charles Ives has tried to utilize the sounds in the town and their reverberations against those very mountains, not to make a picture of them, but to just give you the full sound sense that's around us all the time.
Thank you.
And what the composer, Edgar Varèse, added to this is the psychological side of listening. As he sits, after a nervous breakdown, recovering in a desert, he tries to make a piece of music which captures not just what the desert is itself, but what's missing. Water, for instance. I'm going to play you an interpolation that is something made to be played with a symphony orchestra, but which I'm going to play by itself as the psychological side of feeling a landscape. Interpolation number 2 from the piece Deserts. But old Charlie Ives, long before the tape recorder and the possibility to introduce sounds in that way on the stage, also was involved with reminiscence, with the psychological side, with nostalgia. Usually he could only use tunes, say, for nostalgia to evoke a sense of the past. But anyway, the end of our program at the moment is called Remembrance by Charles Ives.